I'm Dr. Beth Mollison.
And I'm Dr. Alyssa Watson.
Thank you all for joining us in the Veterinary Break Room, where we have short conversations where we chat informally about relevant topics in veterinary medicine. And Alyssa, today's topic, I think, is interesting. We're going to talk about the whole, are vets in it for the money? I know we're not the only ones that have heard people say that, whether it's from peers, in our social circle, or of course, clients, I feel like love to give that impression to us when they're faced with a bill. So we're going to kind of break it down. And I want to start by talking about kind of the theories on, you know, why does it seem that way? Why do we as practicing veterinarians think that that's the impression people have? So what do you think, Alyssa? Do you agree? Do you feel like that's something you hear from your clientele?
I hear it a little bit from the clientele. I think where I find it more frustrating and surprising is from friends or family, where, you know, you hear that phrase, oh, well, and usually it's not even that. It's usually kind of this passive aggressive, oh, could you recommend somebody that's not in it for the money? That's where I get this like visceral response. You know, you have that visceral reaction to that phrase. Right. And I think that that comes from this idea that, you know, we all put our hearts and souls into this profession, and to have somebody question your motivation it gives you this response, you know, for me, this kind of anger. And over the years, mm-hmm. I've learned to temper that anger with a humor a little bit, because that can sometimes help, you know, diffuse it. But I have like a set response to that statement or question. Do we need
to hear it? I want to hear what yours is. Well, just to add on to what you were saying, yes, I feel like even well-intentioned people, like mm-hmm. people you'll meet in social settings, you'll tell them you're a veterinarian and they'll say, oh, you know, that's a great job. Like my dog has put my vet's kids through college. Just things like that, that just make you, like you said, just kind of really irk you, even though you know it wasn't necessarily ill-intentioned. But what's your go-to response?
So generally my go-to response is two-sided. You know, I always tell people, well, for one thing, you know, don't you do your job for money? Of course, people, you know, are in it for money. That's how we make a living. And so, and when you phrase it that way, like, don't you go to your job so that you can make money? People kind of mm-hmm. step back for a second and think, oh, yeah, well, I do that. You know, you can take pleasure in your work and you can be passionate about your job and still need to provide for your family and make money. And then I always say the other thing too is, you know, no one is in it for the money, because there is no money.
Exactly. We'll get to that part.
Is what I generally say. And honestly, you know, that's a little infused humor. There definitely, you can make a good living at this profession, but you have to plan, you know, and you right. have to, you know, I think that there are ways to budget and to look at your expenses. And as the cost of education has grown significantly recently, that might need to adjust. You know, we might need to adjust how we think about saving for things like retirement and everything. You know, there's a lot that goes into, you know, in it for the money besides, or what kind of money are you looking at besides what's your take-home pay, you know, annually?
Sure, absolutely. And I like your response, Alyssa. I think those are good. I'm going to put those in my back pocket. And just to touch on a few of the theories about why does it seem that way, I think one, you know, just to touch on when we are treating pets, I know a lot of us don't always have things like payment plans as an option. So it's not like when you or I walk into a healthcare setting and the focus is on us first, and then somebody other than the doctor and the nurse worries about billing us, billing our insurance. You know, the numbers are not as prominent. And I think a lot of people tend to compare their experience to that, where maybe in the initial conversations, we do have to talk about money and bring up money. So I think that it is a big part of these discussions in a healthcare setting, which I think is maybe a little off-putting to people. Another thing I've noticed too is a lot of what we do is recommend preventive care. You know, we're in there they bring their healthy young dog to us. They don't look at this as something that's going to be expensive. And then suddenly, of course, we're talking about the very responsible things of vaccinations and, you know, parasitic prevention and dental care, testing, dental care. And all of a sudden, I think people get the impression of, you know, what this should, my dog is healthy. This should not be an expensive visit. Of course, I think you could also look at it as, if we were really in it for the money, wouldn't we be letting these pets get sick? It's just interesting, some of those impressions that people have during those initial conversations.
Yeah. And compared to the way that the human healthcare system works, at least in the United States, where a lot of those costs are completely hidden from you, I think that there's starting to be more transparency there too, and people are starting to sit down and take a look at those bills. And I mean, there's entire publications and social media, Reddits and things dedicated to finding those misbillings, you know, where people have been misbilled. And so that is coming to light more. And I'm hopeful that that might help people understand the true cost of a lot of this care. Because as veterinary medicine has advanced so significantly, you know, the things that we can do, that it's exploded, the things that we can do, but no one has seen the cost of that, you know, up front for their own care. So if they don't know how much an x-ray costs for themselves, how can they, you know, estimate in their heads how much an x-ray for their dog should cost?
Absolutely. And you kind of touch on this too, where x-rays, things like that, maybe people are more used to knowing, you know, if they've had pets over their lifetime, may have more of a ballpark cost. But also, as we talk about recent advances in technology and medical advances, you know, suddenly, maybe 30 years ago, people weren't getting faced with an estimate for a total hip replacement that might cost, you know, thousands and thousands of dollars. So suddenly, whereas before, maybe they were recommending an FHO or something, you weren't getting as many various options to treat your pets and as much advanced medical care. And so with that, of course, there's been a rise in cost. And of course, most people out there want to do the gold standard of care for their pets. And so they look at that as, hey, suddenly these costs have risen and I can't afford any of this for my pet. And so I think some of it too is maybe traced back to those medical advances. The other thing I know I have faced too is I feel like a lot of people come in, they feel like they have, you know, done such a good deed. They found a kitten behind the dumpster at their apartment building and everyone is so happy and it's so cute. And then they bring it in and they're faced with this huge bill. I don't know if you ever feel that way, Alyssa, but I feel like they're like, well, this is kind of a good deed that I've done. Why is it suddenly so costly? You know, I think maybe their impression of how much a pet is going to cost might be different than the person who's researched a certain breed for years and is ready to kind of budget for it and has spent thousands of dollars on the pet itself. That might be kind of a different viewpoint on costs going into the pet ownership.
Sure. I think it's, you know, difficult when somebody does feel like, oh, you know, they took in this animal, they've done this good deed, and then to suddenly be faced with a bill that they really weren't expecting. You know, some of it comes back to, I think, too, also how we talk about bringing pets into our home, you know, about using words like adoption and rescuing as opposed to, you know, getting a pet or acquiring a pet. Those little changes in phrasing, you know, that changes the connotation. And on the one hand, that's a good thing, because if animals are considered parts of our, if our pets are considered parts of our family, then we're more, you know, there's a stronger bond, a better emotional attachment. People want to take better care of them. But on the other hand, too, it can also be a little bit of then expecting, you know, care without paying for it or the expectation that, you know, they're entitled to this care because they're part of the family. Does that make sense?
Yeah, absolutely. And I do think people do, underestimate it, especially when they do think of it as just a cute little young tiny acquisition that they're doing their good deed. And I do think they underestimate it. And the other thing too, that at least a lot of times it always circles back to, relatively new thing of pet insurance. And is it our responsibility to really be advocating for that for the pet? Is it our responsibility to be trying to help these pet owners find payment plans when they are faced with large bills? So, Alyssa, I know you do a lot of euthanasia business where this is not as applicable, but do you, in private practice, do you talk to every puppy or kitten owner about pet insurance, or what's the protocol at your practice?
So I don't personally, although we do offer one of the things that my clinic, my group of clinics offers is, wellness plans kind of modeled after Banfield and some of those corporates. So it's a monthly, it's a way to, finance the animal's care over a year or more. Monthly payments that are automatically removed from their account and cover a certain number of things, that preventive care, like we were talking about earlier.
Sure.
Because I do think that people, underestimate the amount of money they're going to spend on a pet. And there's, some interesting data out there about that. And even I was a little bit surprised about how much money, it actually costs. And we're going to talk about that in a little while. But yeah, so payment plans, I don't know. Is that something that, and then is it my responsibility to find out, is this a good company? Like, is this insurance company a good company? Are they going to be one that reimburses? Is that the pet owner's responsibility? That's tough. I remember when I was in school. Yeah, I remember when I was in school, one of the things that was drilled into us was don't make assumptions about what your client can pay. And I've tried to practice that, my whole life. Like, okay, I'm going to set out all of these options, option A, B, and C, and I'm not going to make an assumption about which one you're going to choose. I think for me personally, 20 years ago, that was a lot easier than it is now. Now I feel like when I set out all those options that people, I get more, pushback of, that's too expensive. And so it's really difficult. And I get that people are kind of like upset with me about how expensive it is. Whereas 20 years ago, it was just like, okay, I can't afford that. What's the next thing?
Right. And it's such a fine line to walk and to try to balance. One of the many reasons I think our job is so difficult, because you do want to offer, it's hard. I don't think human medical professionals have to try to come up with three different tiers of care like we are expected to and like we want to. I know I like to provide my pet owners with gold standard options, but I also don't want them to feel excluded or like a bad pet owner if that's not the option they can pursue. It's such a fine balance. And of course it all gets back to cost and what a loaded issue it is. And, I think that brings us to how expensive really is it to own a pet? And I don't even know. I wish I would have made myself kind of guess what the average pet owner cost was before we did some research into this. But the ASPCA did one estimation that we found, and it says annually, and this includes, I thought this was maybe a good way to do it, but it includes all of your preventative care out of pocket, things like grooming, food, and then it also includes health insurance, so whatever I think your deductible would be for the year. And for dogs annually, it looks like it was about $1,400, and for cats, it was about $1,100 or $1,200. So I don't know, Alyssa, what do you think? Is that what you would have guessed, do you think?
I don't think I would have guessed quite that high. But again, when you... So I would have, when you're factoring in everything, food and everything like that, then it makes sense, when you it makes sense to me when I physically see that number. Okay, but that's, you know, that's everything. That's food, all of that. But still, those numbers are real. And so that's one of the places that I think that that underestimation comes in, is like, you don't think about, oh, the, you know, bag of food that you pick up at the grocery store when you're running out, you know, just to get sure. a couple other things. And so, you know, and over the lifetime of a pet, which are getting longer and longer, you know, I mean, we're seeing pets 17, 18, 21 years old. And if you're spending $1,500 a year, that will add up. I was surprised they did also this lifetime of care study. And I think that mm-hmm. was, you know, through Care Credit and another pet insurance company. But that was also a published study. And that they surveyed dog and cat owners, and they found that dog owners could spend as much as $55,000 during their pet's wow. lifetime. And cat owners, a little less, $45,000 to $46,000 was the average. And to me, I thought that those numbers surprised me.
Yeah, those numbers do seem high. And then, but at the same token, you know, when I think of sometimes a pet has one bout with pancreatitis and winds up needing to be hospitalized for 48 hours. And then I, you know, look at what the bill for something like that could be compared to the annual cost if you have health insurance, which is, you know, $1,400. So it depends on how you look at it. Obviously there's such a wide range of care that every pet needs. And yeah, it's certainly interesting to see those numbers in front of us. And it would be interesting too to see a panel of pet owners and what they thought of those numbers, if they thought that was an over or underestimation from what they've experienced. Yep. So Alyssa, all of that leads us to our big question that we started with today, and that is, are we in it for the money? Are we all making bank in this profession? And to try to get the answer to that, I think, well, of course, we all have our firsthand experience, but wanted to get some data. And this was in 2014. JAVMA did publish some information on this. And I will say it with the big caveat of, you know, that was, what, 8 years ago. The climate is very different now, thanks to the pandemic and certainly some other factors as well. So it's hard to say how much of that has changed. But their study found that the overall, what they call NPV, or net present value of obtaining a veterinary degree, was not great. That maybe for men it was a little bit of a positive value, for women a little bit of a negative value, which is depressing in and of itself, the gender discrepancy, but that basically on a basis of financial return alone, a student contemplating entering veterinary school would be better off taking the money and investing it in the stock market. So that was very depressing news to see that our degree might not have the value that maybe we all hope it does. And again, I think looking at it in a different climate, we could hold on to the fact that, I don't know about you, Alyssa, but I feel like we've at least firsthand experienced a lot of increases in salary lately, or at least potential increases in salary. That, of course, doesn't account for the potential you have to be, you know, when we talk about owners and specialists, maybe people that are on the higher end of the salary range. But how does that news sit with you? Is that new information to you, or have you heard about that study before?
So I definitely heard about the study before because, you know, as we said, it is a few years old now. I don't think it is surprising, okay, especially because this is a huge, there's a vast, you know, range of salaries in this profession, as we're talking about. And this factors in, you know, equine and food animal medicine all the way up to sure. specialists. And so what I try to take away from it more than anything else, you know, what I try to take away from it more than, oh, this is depressing and no one should go to vet school because there's no return on investment, is that you can't start to solve a problem until you have some of this data and some of the causes. And so mm-hmm. from my standpoint, I always try to look at it and spin it. So, okay, so now we know that there's this disparity, you know, where can we focus our resources in order to turn that around so that you can still go to school, do the thing that you love doing or that you've always wanted to do since you were 5 years old, and make a decent living. But then the question becomes, what's a decent living, right?
I like that outlook, Alyssa. That's very positive. And, you know, I think, too, it's good to look at, you know, I have to imagine this isn't the only degree that has found itself kind of with similar breakdown of statistics. And the way I look at it, you know, if you have to be doing something with your life, you know, choosing it just based on the money is not always the best answer either, because then you mm-hmm. might find yourself in a profession that is not a good fit. I also think it brings us to the overarching question, like I just alluded to, you know, is it all about the money? Are we here to choose a degree that's just going to give us the biggest differential in those two numbers? I think a lot of us would say the answer is no. Would you agree, Alyssa?
I would. I absolutely would. And like I was saying, you know, it comes down to, you know, what amount of money do you need to be happy, or at least be comfortable, so that you're not worried, you know, about your financial future. And you know, there's some data about that too, not just on veterinarians, but as you know, on people in, you know, North America overall. You know, it was a while ago now, but there was that study about how, you know, you really need like $75,000 a year annual salary to be happy. Yeah. It was interesting. There was a tech CEO that decided to, you know, pay all of his employees $75,000 a year, you know, and based on that study. And he did this whole big experiment. So everybody that worked for the company, and it was a smaller company, you mm-hmm. know, got $75,000 a year, regardless of what they did. And it was interesting. I can't remember the guy's name, but you know, if you Google it, I'm sure you can find it. And that only lasted a couple of years. And I think that's because, you know, that doesn't really take into account, you know, what your debt is. And so mm-hmm. there was another exactly. study that I saw, which I thought was more accurate about what net worth you need in order to be comfortable. And so for that, they said something about having a net worth of about $775,000 was where you need to be. And for me, that's more of a kind of more of a focus, because it takes into account sure. not only what salary you're making, but also what debt. And that's a big thing for veterinarians, you know, what kind of debt we're incurring in order to, you know, have this profession.
Exactly. And I think that's the underlying thing we haven't stated, is when it comes to that ratio of value of the veterinary degree, so much of that can be traced back to just that not necessarily low salaries, but more that high burden of debt that so many of us graduate with. But those are just very interesting numbers. I always love looking at the numbers and all these studies that I wouldn't have even thought to do about, you know, what number is it that gives you life satisfaction. So I do mm-hmm. think that's a good thing to keep in mind when we talk about that value of our veterinary degree before we get too depressed, is are we still able to maintain, you know, a normal lifestyle?
Yep. And I think you could definitely do it, but it does take some planning.
Yeah. And I think the big takeaway here is to answer the question that we started with. I think maybe most of us could agree that we are not in it for the money. And maybe we can take some of Alyssa's talking points from the beginning of the episode to take with us to remember to use when people kind of allude to that snidely or directly. Mm-hmm. But anyway, Alyssa, let's end on some more good news. I want to hear your win of the week this week. Are there any wins that you've thought of to share?
Yeah, absolutely. I want to share. So my win of the week involves you. So
I always like that.
So new year. So it's a new year, and focusing on the new year, one of the things that always comes top to mind is where am I going to get all of my continuing education? And so starting off the new year, Western Veterinary Conference, WVC, they have moved during COVID. They kind of had shifted that towards the end of the year, and now it's shifted back towards the beginning of the year again. And I heard that you are coming out to Las Vegas. So I'm so excited for that. We need to get together again.
We will definitely have to. I love that that's your win. And yes, for anybody listening that cares, I am in Cincinnati and Alyssa is in Las Vegas. So not only will I get to get some CE, meet up with some other coworkers, but get to see Alyssa. So that is a big win. And it's not, let's see, I think the conference this year is what, like February 23rd. So people listening should still have time to register if they're like, oh, Alyssa needs some more CE credits. Or of course, a plug for our Clinician's Brief CE. We have a lot of free on our website too. So my win is somewhat similar, Alyssa. Well, of course, getting to go to Vegas in February is exciting. And then I also did something that I don't take for granted anymore post-COVID. And that's last night I planned a family trip for us this summer, which I also am always one of those people that's like, how am I supposed to know what I want to do in 6 months? And then by the time I decide I want to go on vacation, it's like, oh, well, you needed to like find somewhere 6 months ago. So this year in January, I have planned a June vacation. We're going to go to Michigan, and it's not only me and my immediate family, but my parents are going to go, my sister and her family are going to go. And best part is we're all staying in separate housing. So it's going to be great, hopefully. But anyway, lots to look forward to with the new year. I hope everyone in our audience is doing well. Thank you everyone for listening or watching, and we will see you all soon.
We'll see y'all next time. Thanks.
Thank you for listening to today's episode of Veterinary Break Room. If you enjoyed today's episode, you can find us wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts, including a video version on YouTube. While you're there, make sure you subscribe, rate, and review. You can also listen to or watch our podcast episodes on our website at cliniciansbrief.com/podcasts, or drop us a line at podcasts@briefmedia.com. Veterinary Break Room is a Brief Media production produced by Alexis Ussery and co-hosted by Dr. Alyssa Watson and Dr. Beth Mollison.